U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
President Biden announces a bipartisan infrastructure deal and then almost immediately throws it under the bus. What's in the proposal and what are its legislative chances? Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, WSJ columnists Kim Strassel and Bill McGurn. On Thursday, outside the White House, Joe Biden met the press surrounded by a group of senators, including Democrats Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin, and Republicans Susan Collins and Rob Portman. And here's part of what Biden said. We have a deal, he added, that I think it's really important. We've all agreed that none of us got all that we wanted, unquote. And from the Republican side, here's a line from Ohio Senator Rob Portman. This is roads and bridges, but also lots of other kinds of infrastructure, including broadband, our water system, our rail system, all of which is good for the economy, unquote. And so, Kim, I guess the place to start here is what exactly is in this proposal put out by the White House and these senators?
Sure. So as expected, it's about a $1.2 trillion deal over 8 years, and about 579 of that is new spending, meaning spending above what was already baseline considered infrastructure dollars that would be going out. And they have a breakdown. There's about $109 billion for roads and bridges and other major projects, another $73 for power infrastructure, $66 for passenger and freight rail, you know, $65 for broadband, almost $50 for public transport. You can go down the list. It does seem to be focused on physical infrastructure. There's certainly a bipartisan element to this from the start in terms of where the dollars are going. And I would note that even in the physical infrastructure realm, there are big divides about where money should go. Republicans tend to focus a lot more on roads and bridges, the things that commuters use to get to work. But Democrats tend to focus more on public transport, subways, things like Amtrak. So if you broke it out, there's probably about an even divide there. They managed to come around. And then there's the part of it, the pay-fors, and there's about more than a dozen of them noted. I think one thing that's very worrisome is that there's no breakouts yet, really, of where all the different money will come from, because it still needs to be scored. But a lot of it looks very gimmicky. The group wanted to avoid controversial things like new user fees, like raising the gas tax or putting a new fee on electric vehicles for miles traveled. And so instead, we have a lot of really, I call them snake oil provisions, like IRS enforcement. We're just going to, you know, toughen up the IRS and squeeze more dollars out of people, or we'll look at the unemployment insurance program and make sure it's getting all of its dollars. And I'm not quite sure how these things will hold up.
Yeah, a couple of the revenue provisions that jumped out at me were 5G spectrum auction proceeds and strategic petroleum reserve sales. And if that's where you're getting your funding for your big infrastructure deal, I question how much money you're actually going to get from that. Although I suppose the positive spin on this would be that this deal doesn't have any of the big corporate tax hike or individual tax hike that Biden has proposed. On the spending side, Bill, there were two lines that jumped out at me. So we don't have any legislative text on this yet. It's just this framework that's been agreed on. So what I'm looking at is this White House fact sheet on it. And one of them is that it says that this would be the largest federal investment in passenger rail since the creation of Amtrak. And then there's also $7.5 billion for electric vehicle infrastructure. And the White House fact sheet says this would accomplish the president's goal of building 500,000 EV chargers, which is something that Biden had been talking about during the campaign. So, I mean, if you look at this from the standpoint, Bill, of this is a bipartisan group trying to cobble together something that each side can stand to pass, there are some things in there that look like they are provisions Joe Biden really, really wants to get through.
Yeah, it's funny. I was struck by the same thing, the 500,000 electric vehicle chargers. To me, that it looks like such an innocent and concrete kind of thing. And I just wonder 5 years from now, what the catastrophe will look like. You know, we'll have these stations with no chargers or no one using them, or they don't work. It just looks to me like setting up defeat. You know, the other language in the statement you mentioned, it was very vague. You know, it talked about clean transportation infrastructure, clean water structure. I mean, by clean, they mean green, which means more expensive, probably dubious capability, whether it's equal to what it's replacing and so forth. I mean, again, look at Texas and the energy shortage because they've gone for greener alternatives. So right now, it's still at a very, very vague sense. You know, maybe I'm among the few, but I didn't even think the compromise in you know, what the Republicans were in the infrastructure of the bridges, I didn't think it was really about infrastructure even for the Republicans. It might have been better because it was less than what the Democrats were originally proposing. But I'm just very suspicious about federal spending on infrastructure. I think it should be very narrow and tailored. And when you're bragging about the size of your investment, and remember, investment means we're spending taxpayer dollars, I think you're just setting yourself up for a big failure.
So that's the policy side. But the political story yesterday was maybe even more interesting, because hours after Biden had this group of senators and was saying that none of us got everything that we wanted, he had another press event where he threatened to veto the deal unless it comes paired with a bigger spending bill passed by Democrats through the Senate's reconciliation, budget reconciliation process. Here's part of what Biden said. He said, "We need physical infrastructure, but we also need the human infrastructure as well." And then he added, "If this is the only thing that comes to me, I'm not signing it." So, Kim, I mean, what do you make of this? Is this the fastest political double cross of all time?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, some of us who have covered Washington for a long time, we're not necessarily surprised when people step away from bipartisan promises. But this has to have been a record to have done it within a couple of hours to renege on all of your promises. And, you know, you have to imagine that the GOP negotiators were not aware that this was coming because they sort of look like fools at this point. It was a really rotten thing to do. And I think it will bring a big question as to whether or not Republicans can now, any of them can support this deal. We haven't really heard much from the actual negotiators, Republican negotiators, but a good example is Lindsey Graham, who had tentatively said he supported the process for this. He now says he's out. In a comments, he said, "This is extortion. The Dems are being told that you can't get your bipartisan work product passed unless you sign on to what the left wants. And I'm not playing that game." And he finished, "I don't mind bipartisanship, but I'm not going to do a suicide mission." And I'm sure that that's reflective of a lot of Republicans, because look, the idea here was, let's come together and decide what we can all agree on and can all get out. And what you now have the Biden team saying is, "Well, you know what? That's nice, but we wanted another $3 to $6 trillion worth of spending. And so unless you give us all of it, you're not getting even the things we agree on." And that's not leadership, and it's certainly not a bipartisan attitude. It's governing from the progressive left.
And if you're counting noses, Lindsey Graham, well, of course, we need 10 Republicans here to break the Senate filibuster and get this passed. Lindsey Graham was reportedly the 11th Republican who was in favor of this bipartisan negotiation. And if he's saying he's out, then we're down to 10, which leaves no more room for error. And the other thing that I thought was so interesting, Bill, about Graham's statement is, he essentially made the argument that he thinks the Republican negotiators in this deal were sort of a trick, that they didn't see this coming. They didn't expect Biden to do this. He said most Republicans could not have known that. There's no way. And then he added that that Biden's statement essentially makes the Republicans look like idiots.
Well, it does, right? And some of us saw this. Last week when we were talking about this, you mentioned the best argument for a deal. In other words, if the Republicans could get some infrastructure deal with a lot more limited spending, and since the public sort of likes infrastructure, likes the sound of it, then it would be harder for the Democrats to get the more progressive elements, which aren't as popular because it would be stripped out from the bill. I think we've now seen that was a big risk, and we've now seen that's not in the game. I mean, Joe Biden's made clear he wants the whole Megillah that the Democrats are proposing. So I think, again, last week we were saying the problem with this from the start is that it wasn't ever really a good faith compromise. It was an attempt to get credit for doing something bipartisan, and you give some of the Republicans a chance to vote for something as opposed to voting against it, while just getting your wish list, your original wish list, without any compromise, done in another direction. So it was never a compromise. I think the Republicans should have seen that. In some ways, by doing it as blatantly, Kyle, as you suggest, you know, I mean, Joe Biden did it out in the full sunshine where everyone can see, and it does make a lot of these Republicans look like idiots. I think he's made it easier for Mitch McConnell to gather up his team and get a focus and not go down this primrose path.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. So before the break, Bill was making the argument for the Republicans to go along with some kind of bipartisan infrastructure deal. And I mean, as I understand it, the argument is that you can get something done, some of which maybe you actually want, some of this road funding. You can show bipartisanship works. You can undercut the argument that the Senate filibuster really needs to go. And then, Kim, I gather that part of it, too, also is that if you get the roads and bridges done now, then maybe a moderate senator like Joe Manchin might not go along for this $4 trillion or whatever the price tag ends up being, this reconciliation bill full of what Joe Biden is calling human infrastructure.
Yeah, that's the argument for going ahead. And you briefly touched on all of those claims. I think the big one that's on people's mind is you have to look at the bigger debate that's going on at the moment. Chuck Schumer has made clear he's going to continue bringing up these bills that are very radical and that do not have any GOP support, things like the voting rights bill that was filibustered this week. And he's going to use Republican blocking of those bills to make the argument to Democrats for why they should all join together and kill the filibuster. So the argument here is, look, you come to this bipartisan deal, you pass it. It's kind of a pressure release valve. It takes a little bit of steam out of that Schumer argument that Republicans are obstructionist and keeps the Manchins and Sinemas on side protecting the filibuster. Also, as you mentioned, the notion that infrastructure is the sweetener of this deal. You take it out and suddenly all the great big progressive programs that are in the second piece that they want to do through reconciliation, suddenly the price tag looks very huge and they all look like big entitlements that are very partisan. And again, maybe that makes a number of Democratic senators, especially those up for re-election, or again, those who are more centrist like Manchin or Sinema, shy away from reconciliation. The flip side of that argument is that if you go along with this, you make it all the easier potentially for Democrats to just load up everything else they want. They'll put a lot of pressure on every Democrat to get in line, and that you are basically greasing the skids, not just for this $1.2 trillion package, but for another one that, if you listen to Bernie Sanders, he says wants to be in the $6 trillion range.
But one of the unknowns here is whether all 50 Democrats are on board for that kind of bill. And Joe Manchin, the West Virginia moderate, seems to be hedging his bets a little bit already. So he was asked by a reporter about doing these two bills in tandem, doing the bipartisan bill and then a bigger Democrat-only budget reconciliation bill. And here's what he said. It doesn't seem to be fair to me, but they're going to make those decisions. But we have to see what's in the other plan before I can say, oh, yes, you vote for this and I'll vote for that. That's not what I have signed up for, unquote. So, Bill, it's not even clear that this strategy that Biden is now moving forward on to do these two bills in tandem, that he has all the Democrats in the Senate on board for that.
Yeah, it's not clear. But again, it's not clear the other way either. I would hate to have the Republican future rest on what Joe Manchin might be thinking that day. You know, he says some things and he backs off. You just don't know. And that's why I think it was a danger to go along all along for the Republicans to get on this train. You know, I hope that there are tensions in there. It reflects a larger tension between what the progressive wing of the Democratic Party wants and what, say, Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema might want. But the question is, who's going to get their way? And right now, Joe Biden seems to be pretty clearly siding with the progressive wing. I think Chuck Schumer is afraid of an AOC primary challenge, so he wants to keep the progressive flank happy. So I'm not seeing a lot of ways, except maybe on the filibuster, because I think Sinema's taken a very clear stand on that it's going to change, that the Republicans are really going to be able to hold the line in any deal with the Democrats. I think the Democrats are insisting on most of what the progressives want. And the people that we're counting on, two senators, Manchin and Sinema, I'm not sure we can count on them.
Well, as far as this bipartisan deal is concerned, I guess I remain pretty skeptical that this thing is going to get off the ground. And a couple of caveats here. First of all, we still only have this framework. So who knows, Kim, what the final legislative text will look like. Maybe it will get amended. Maybe it will get stuffed up with earmarks, you know, like a Christmas turkey. And all of that could make it harder to pass. If you have 10 Republicans that are on board for some 30,000 foot framework, it seems to me like there's a lot of work and a big challenge to keep them all on board as the job gets down to writing all the dirty details.
Well, not just the Republicans, but that math that you mentioned requires not just 10 Republicans, but every one of the Democrats. And so we're talking a lot about Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, the people that were involved in crafting this deal. But you have 45 other Democrats who may out of, you know, now, will they come along if reconciliation is also on the table? Maybe, probably, although that would also depend on whether or not the reconciliation bill is big enough. That gets very complicated as well, too. You know, what I read from Joe Manchin's comments there is he might be open to doing some kind of reconciliation, but the price tag would matter. He might want something more like $1 trillion instead of the six that Bernie wants. And so if you end up with, let's say, a trillion or a $2 trillion reconciliation package and a $1 trillion infrastructure bill, you have in theory satisfied Joe Biden's demands that both of these bills come to your desk. But that doesn't mean Elizabeth Warren is happy. It doesn't mean Bernie Sanders is happy or, you know, Jeff Merkley, you know, name all of the different progressives in the Senate. And if you can't convince every single one of them to come along, you have no deal on either side.
And then you have to throw in the narrow math in the House, too. The House right now is 220 Democrats to 211 Republicans. So if four Democrats decide they don't like a $1 trillion package, $1 trillion reconciliation bill is just not enough, then you have a tie vote. And so there's also a challenge here, Bill, for Nancy Pelosi and her caucus, which is, I would say, much to the left of the Senate Democratic caucus.
Yes, it is. And it has those tensions. You know, another tension that it has is there are several Democratic representatives from high tax state like New York, New Jersey, Illinois, and California who say they're not going to vote for any of this agenda unless they get a promise that the 2017 tax reform, which eliminated the state and local tax deduction, they're not going to vote for it unless that deduction is restored. Now, that doesn't have broad support among the entire Democratic caucus, because most of them, their voters are not as affected by it as the voters in those states. But it's another element. So she has trouble. I would think that on the Republican side, parties that do not have the White House, and especially when they don't have Congress either, are really in the wilderness. And Republicans, are suffering, especially they have to rebrand themselves, in a post-Trump era. And one of the things I think that they really need to do is brand themselves as guardians of the taxpayers' dollars and so forth. This is all about just big spending that I think if you went on an individual basis, really cannot be justified. It's like the shovel-ready projects in 2009. And I think Republicans have to make that case to the American people. We're not going along. We're going to hold the line and try to keep, your dollars from just, blowing out the door on all sorts of questionable projects.
And then two final caveats here. One is that these revenue provisions, Kim, you mentioned, are very hazy. And at some point, this would get turned into legislative text, and then it would get analyzed and scored by the Congressional Budget Office. And it seems to me there's a pretty decent possibility that the CBO could say, this is not going to raise the kind of revenue you guys think, and your math doesn't add up here. And then you have a real problem here.
Especially because, again, when you go back and you look at that list of pay-fors, there's some definite scraping of the bottom of the barrel, which suggests there wasn't a lot left behind that you could use to fill in those gaps, as you mentioned. A few other things that they had, you mentioned oil sales from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve and spectrum sales. One that will be interesting to me because it's a great big blank area, although I think it was left purposely that way because it could potentially be a way of making up any problems with a CBO score, is they had just a vague definition of unused COVID money from 2020. Well, how much is that? How much is sitting out there? How much is the Biden team willing to use? In the past, they had said they didn't want to use any priorly appropriated COVID money because all of it had a purpose and all of it had a destination. This was clearly a give on their part. How big is that unknown pot? And could it be expanded even more if they chose to make up some of the shortfall of any CBO score? So that was definitely an interesting aspect of this too.
One final thought here is that so far we have a bipartisan proposal and some bullet points out there, and nobody really, at least in the political arena, is so far making the case against this. And eventually that will happen. And it seems to me there are some points of this that are could be made pretty unpopular. I mean, the top revenue raiser is this increased IRS enforcement. And Bill, as we've talked about on a previous podcast, part of the White House's plan here is to require banks to tell the IRS the annual inflows and outflows of everybody's bank accounts, essentially. And that's the way to increase the IRS enforcement and get some money that the IRS is supposed to be getting. But it seems to me there's a huge privacy issue there, and I don't think it would take a lot of pushing to make that idea pretty unpopular among the public.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I think the IRS should be a Republican focus. Look, there are two approaches to maximizing tax revenue. One is to have a very simple tax system that everyone can see is simple, clear, and fair, and it's not worth people's effort to cheat and hire tax attorneys and so forth. The other is to have a complicated code and then turn your IRS into this giant police force, always trying to sniff out your private information and so forth and your savings. And the assumption is that you're guilty until proven innocent. I don't think the American people want an agency like that, especially if you look at the past, its abuses, like what Lois Lerner did to some of these conservative groups. And basically there was no punishment for it at all. What we've seen they've done, and they can't even keep these tax returns confidential the way that they're supposed to. So I think the answer is actually to starve the IRS and limit its powers. It's one, you know, it's, you know, we think of the FBI and the CIA and police and so forth, but the IRS really has greater power to ruin individual citizens. So I agree with you. I think it's a big winning argument to say, do we really want a stronger, bigger IRS in the lives of the American people? I know I don't, and I suspect, Kyle, you're right that most Americans don't.
Thank you, Kim and Bill. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.